History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative to ask a few questions and then exercise the patience to listen as memories that may have been buried for decades emerge once again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 99-year-old Jack Kappeler of Bakersfield, California. That part of the Golden State has a long history in the oil business, and Jack spent his career as part of that industry. But first, he had to survive his time as a Navy fighter pilot during World War II. We're going to hear about those adventures and also a little bit about Jack's older brother, Frank, a navigator on one of those B-25s that famously flew off of the USS Hornet to strike Tokyo as part of the Doolittle Raid in 1942. Let's talk first, Jack, about your childhood. Tell me where you grew up and what you remember about those early years.
Born and raised in Alameda, California, a family of two boys. My brother was 9 years older than me, and he was my model. I did everything he told me to do, and he was a great leader.
And that's a Navy town, huh?
Yeah, it's right on the bay, and yeah. When they first got the Navy into Alameda, they got carriers coming in, so I got to watch carriers coming in and out. They didn't do any landings on the carriers, but they did use the base for carrier qualification.
And anybody that goes to the Bay Area now, one of the things they notice and they look for are those big bridges. I don't think those were there when you were growing up.
I was going to grammar school and high school. Both bridges were being built, the Golden Gate and the Bay Bridge, yeah. So every morning you'd get to see a little more improvement on the bridges. Took them 20 years to build both of them, yeah.
And, you know, you're growing up during the era we know now as the Great Depression. Was that something that your family felt? Did you see evidence that things weren't the way they're supposed to be?
Oh, yeah. I had kids that their dads lost their jobs. They didn't have enough to have food in the house. I knew my mother helped out families in my neighborhood that were without dads, without jobs. My dad brought neon into the United States and had a company of neon products. That was the height of his career. He made more money then, I guess, than afterwards. So we were a pretty lucky family, yeah.
So the neon signs up and down the East Bay, those were all built by your dad?
Yeah, most of them were all right in Oakland, yeah. Uh-huh. We went to the Hawaiian Islands for, I guess, when the company became incorporated. And out of Waikiki at night, they had an introduction of the company to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I was, what, 7, 8 years old, and I never forgot that. Quite impressive.
I could see how that would stick in your head. And I want to get the whole scope of this. So the very first neon signs in America were brought here by your father?
That was my understanding, yeah. They had a sign company, uh-huh, with the light bulbs that you screwed in.
Yeah.
And it was the Electrical Products Corporation, uh-huh, of Oakland. They got the original contracts or patents for neon, yeah. First signs they put up, going into Hawaii on one of the islands out there. It wasn't a man-made island, I guess. They had a neon sign, "Welcome to Hawaii." That was one of the first signs that they used to publicize the company.
Did you ever talk to him or hear his account of how that came to be, where he got the idea or what told him this was going to work?
It's just kind of evolved. As far as he was a sheet metal worker, and his salesman was a graduate, I guess he had a PhD and smart enough to know what to do. And he got the guys going and formed the company, yeah.
And you mentioned the Welcome to Hawaii sign. Were there any other signs that were memorable to you that you used to drive by or see and say, hey, that's because of my dad?
The one down here, the roof of the hotel the big sign there they put up is still there. Padre, yeah.
In Bakersfield?
Yeah, I guess it's still there.
How about that? Yeah.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned that you did everything your brother did, but do you remember as a young boy having some ideas in your head, hey, someday this is what I'm going to do, these are my hopes, my dreams, my ambitions?
Yeah, yeah. Well, my brother got put into the Air Force, and I don't know why, just to be contrary, I guess. I studied more about the Navy aviation, and I became a real addict of naval aviation. Living in Alameda, I saw all the carriers come in there and saw all the carrier planes. That became more my desire than flying in the Air Force.
And a lot of times when I talk to guys who flew, there's often a moment early on where something got their attention that gave them that flying bug or made them think, hey, maybe I can do that someday.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I got a ride from somebody at Oakland Airport in a plane, and that ticked me off. Geez, maybe I can do this.
And your brother went in the Army Air Corps before World War II, I'm guessing, huh? Do you remember what you thought about that or what your view was?
Everybody was doing it. You know, I say everybody.
Sure.
And most of the guys that were out of school and had the education could qualify going into the service. They made more money in the service than they did in civilian life. Yeah.
Let's talk about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember that day and how you found out what happened?
As I recall, it was early in the morning. I think I was at home, yeah. Well, I was in the service waiting to be called into the Navy at that time.
You turned 19 2 days before this happened. When you heard that news, was that eye-opening? Was that a jolt? How would you describe the impact of that news, what had happened out there?
I was a young kid, I gung-ho to go in and fly, and my brother had been Air Force, and I had to be contrary. I always had looked up to the Navy, so that was going to be my desire, to fly in the Navy. Yeah. And the communications in those days wasn't very good. You'd have a run radio that maybe you'd get it. No TV. You didn't see anything on TV.
How did you feel about your brother being in the war, since he was in before you?
Yeah, real proud of him. He was my model, to try to follow and do everything he had done. But I was anti-Air Force. I was always in favor of the Navy. And we continued that the day he died.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you concerned at all that he might not come home from this war?
Never thought about it, no. Kids don't get involved in that. I never thought that way. We lived in Alameda, so the Hornet was docked in the docks at Alameda Naval Air Station. So, yeah, he left from there, and we put him on board and watched him go, not knowing where they were going.
But because of your awareness and your familiarity with naval aviation, you noticed that there was something aboard that carrier that wouldn't usually be there?
Oh, yeah, I thought unusual that they put V-25s on a carrier. That's really never been done before. And, of course, they use the excuse they were just transporting them.
So you and your family go to see your brother off. It's the USS Hornet, CV-8. In Alameda, and you being an aviation guy yourself, you notice, hey, there's B-25 bombers on an aircraft carrier. They've never flown off an aircraft carrier. What's going on?
Right.
And I know your brother and the rest of those men who were about to become the Doolittle Raiders, they weren't allowed to talk about any of this, but did he say anything at all to you before you said goodbye that maybe gave you just a little hint of the history he was about to be a part of?
Oh, nothing. Just keep watching the news. Keep watching the news. It's gonna, something big will come up, and when that happens, you know I'm involved.
Tell me your feelings about that, because I'm sure you've read a lot, watched a lot. You probably talked to him about it a little bit. If someone had asked you to fly a B-25 off a carrier when it had never been done before, do you think you would have said, yeah, I'll do it?
I have no idea. At that time, everybody was all gung-ho to do anything they could for the military. And I guess I would have, yeah, even though I wasn't qualified.
And we just passed the 80th anniversary of the Doolittle Raid. It's a long time ago. A lot has been said and written. But how do you view it? Give me your description of what they did and why it was significant.
Well, I think actually it caused a change in the whole war from the Japanese standpoint. They had been on the offensive. And that's the thing that made them pull their horns in. They had antlers out in the Pacific everywhere. But once that happened, it went to the homeland, things changed, and they restructured their defense. And I think it was really important, yeah.
Have you ever tried to wrap your brain around the odds involved and what could have happened or what many of them figured would happen?
Never ever thought about it, no. Most of the time you never do. You figure you're going to succeed. And that's what makes you succeed, I think, having that attitude.
Well, yeah, and I'm interested in your view, and maybe if there's anything your brother ever shared with you about it, I'd be interested in hearing that. But I'm just wondering how much courage it takes, A, to sign up for it, B, to do it, knowing you can't come back to the carrier, you don't know where you're going to land or who's going to find you when you do, if you're able to land.
You know, most of the times when you're in a situation like that, you don't think of the outcome. You accomplish what you're set to do, and after that's happened, you're going to make the best of what you can do. I think everybody kind of felt that way, yeah.
And are there some things that, after the fact, your brother shared with you about his experience on that mission?
Oh, yeah. He ended up in China. He was quite impressed with the Chinese and all the help they got. And that impressed me, listening to his tales.
And from what I read, the B-25 that he was on, crew number 11, its engine stopped 10,000 feet over China because they ran out of gas, and they actually had to bail out in the dark of night.
Yeah, I guess he did parachute out, but not all of them did.
And then they found some friendlies on the ground to help guide them to safety?
Chinese did, yeah. They evaded the Japanese for quite a while. Several of them that had been in the Doolittle group, yeah. Although the natives helped them, the Chinese.
And he would go on to fly 53 missions in Europe before the war was over and made it a career in the Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel in the 1960s. But you said when you saw him off and you asked about the B-25s on the carrier, he said, watch the news. So give me those developments from your perspective. How did you find out what had happened and what was that like when you saw what they had done?
It was a shock, yeah, to be that close to what really happened, yeah. And nobody else in the world knew what they did, yeah.
And was there a period of time where your family didn't know if he had survived or not?
Oh, yeah, yeah, quite a while. Being a young guy, that didn't bother me much. I knew he'd get out of it.
Did he know?
I don't think so, no. I think any of them did. They had to take it the way it was. It wasn't any other way.
Do you remember when you finally found out that he was alive, that he'd made it through?
Yeah, that was a real occasion in the house. In fact, in the whole nation, they were celebrating the Doolittle raid, yeah.
All that was happening before you had a chance to fly. Did all of that have any impact on you and your focus or what you wanted to do?
At the time, I didn't know it. Uh-huh. Yeah, sure it did. Yeah.
And you told us, you know, the rivalry between the Army Air Corps, later the Air Force, and you as a naval aviator. So tell me about that journey. What was your first taste of it in the Navy?
Well, you go through, I went through pre-flight, which is, what, 3 or 4 months of hell. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with aviation. So I had a lot of time to think. And it's at the time you thought, is this ever going to pay out? Is it worth doing? But in the end, it did, yeah.
Where'd you do that pre-flight?
St. Mary's pre-flight school. Yeah.
I hear they had a pretty good football team back then, the St. Mary's pre-flight team.
Probably did away with it when the war started. We never had, I don't think we went into their games when I was at St. Mary's.
I'm just wondering what it felt like for you when you finally got to fly, when you were at the controls and you were up there.
Well, I did it before that in a Cub, doing it on your own, you know, with not a military program. So I had gotten a little feeling of it ahead of time. It was an accomplishment, yeah.
And, you know, I've also talked to a lot of guys over the years who they signed up to be a pilot, but that didn't work out. They washed out or they ended up as navigators or engineers or gunners or whatever. Was there ever a day where you weren't sure you were going to cut the mustard?
Never, no. I don't know what I would have done.
That does seem to be on the checklist. The requirements for being a fighter pilot is confidence. Yeah. So where'd you go from there? When you're done at St. Mary's, what was next?
Oh, that was to get you in physical condition to become an aviator, they said, making you run every morning and just athletics. Yeah, a little bit of classwork, but not much.
Mm-hmm. And what other aircraft did you get to fly along the way?
Started with steerman and the training. And then we stepped right away up to what we called a TV-2. It was a Vultee. We called the Vultee Vibrator, 440 horsepower. And then the AT-6. So not too much in training aircraft. Three of them. Melbourne, Florida, Corpus Christi. They had several fields, outlying fields, around Corpus. So you'd go through those, depending on what kind of plane you flew, you'd go through one of those fields just for those airplanes. So for the Hellcat, I was at a small field just outside of Houston.
And, you know, during all that training, did you ever have any hiccups, any close calls, any incidents that concerned you a little bit?
Yeah, I lost my teeth along the way. I had many. None of them I really want to talk about.
We want to know.
We're just trying to put ourselves in your shoes or in your cockpit, so to speak, and understand what it's like.
Most of my downfall, I'm sure, was my own fault, and I hate to sit to talk about it. I was up at Livermore. They had, I was just on a night flight. Nothing was wrong. They briefed you. If you ever have anything wrong, we got behind the seat. They've got flares. You can pull a flare out. And you can see that flare for 50 miles. So I said, where did he say that flare was? And yeah, it was nothing to do. And now, where in the heck was that handle for the reaching around and looking and trying to think that I had might be all ready to pull the handle when I had to. I reached around and pulled it up and, oops, there it is. It went off in the cockpit. Scared the hell out of me.
I think that would happen to a lot of people. Yeah. And it probably was loud and bright.
It was bright. It lit up the whole sky.
So you almost shot yourself down.
Lucky the wings didn't burn up. Oh, yeah. Fabric. The whole plane was fabric.
Well, he made it through that close call in training and plenty more once he got overseas. It is time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Jack Kappeler of Bakersfield, California. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a short video of Jack explaining how he lost his two front teeth during World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.